Welcome to Change Surfer Radio. I'm Dr. J. For the next half hour, keep your mind open and your radio tuned to the left as we present a sexy high-tech vision of a radically democratic future. Today on Change Surfer Radio, we'll be listening to a talk I gave at the University of Toronto on August 5, 2004, on Buddhism and Transhumanism, the Technologies of Self-Perfection. The talk was part of a day-long symposium organized by the World Transhumanist Association on Religious Transhumanism, a symposium that preceded that weekend's Transvision Conference at the University of Toronto. I'll be broadcasting a number of the talks given at these two gatherings over the course of the next couple of weeks, and then the rest will be available for download at the website of the World Transhumanist Association, which I'm the executive director of, at transhumanism.org. And if you think it's self-indulgent for me to broadcast my own talk, it's okay, because Buddhists don't believe in the self. When I finally sat down to write this talk, I was better prepared in one respect than usual. I hadn't done the research that I'd intended, or polished the fine bon mots that I'd intended. But the theme of the talk is the cultivation of enlightened personality. And when I finally forced myself to write, I was acutely aware of how unenlightened my personality is. I'd spent a day reacting with anger and impatience to my children and my wife, contributing to an escalating feedback loop with them. I'd procrastinated and used all my avoidance skills to ignore two or three writing tasks at the top of my to-do queue, working on less necessary things. I had taken mega doses of stimulants in order to stay up and work, and then lost motivation around midnight and spent three precious sleep hours on embarrassing entertainments that filled me with self-loathing. Instead of sticking to my renewed Atkins diet the next morning, I gave in again and ate a banana slathered with peanut butter for breakfast. And then as I sat down to write, I stared at the latest issue of Tricycle magazine and indulged in odious comparisons. Tricycle's the leading Buddhist journal of thought in the U.S., and it's filled with excellent writers who all have 20 years of daily work on their meditation cushions, as well as exquisite writing skills. Ugh, I thought, when was the last time I had watched a breath on my cushion? The last meditative moment I remember was an acute hour last week of self-awareness and reflection on the proximity of death that I spent during a talk, I was listening to somebody else talk, about how to structure a committee to work on making your congregation ecologically sustainable. And believe me, that was an excruciating hour of self-examination. In other words, I was prepared to write about the technological transcendence of impatience, sloth, envy, inattentiveness, and foolishness, because I can use all the help I can get. At some point in the next coming century, this century, I'm sure we will face the problem and opportunity of people with nanoscale pharmacies in their brains and tripped out on nanoneural architectures, tapping into the Satori circuit in the brain and the tripping the light fantastic when they should be driving. We will have to figure out if that is the same thing as Satori the hard way, and what contexts it should be used in, and how we incorporate it into ethical and spiritual and philosophical life. But the much more mundane spiritual task for us all as people trying to live our lives day to day is to figure out how to be more patient, how to remain vigorous and attentive and ethical, and how to find wisdom moment to moment. In the Mahayana Buddhist tradition, the enlightened person and the person who aspires to discover their enlightened personality are both referred to as the bodhisattva. A whole disquisition could be given on how the supernatural aspects that are attributed to Buddhas and bodhisattvas over the ages sound remarkably like the abilities of the science fiction post-human superbeings that we transhumanists aspire to become. Things like multiplying your personality into myriad forms and then pulling it all back together, or flying around on a moon disk in a heavenly realm making fun of the narcotized lotus eaters by playing tricks with their space-time. But I don't want to go there. Instead, I want to talk about the six personality traits, or virtues, that the Mahayana tradition teaches the bodhisattva cultivates on the path to greater perfection. These traits are known as paramitas. It's usually translated as perfections, but just for the same reason that I don't like to use the term immortality, because it implies a kind of a finalness to it all. The concept of paramita is really a more daily, ongoing task, and it's the literal translation of paramita is getting to the other shore. And as you know, probably from your cursory examination of Buddhism, the idea is not just to just get there, it's to continue to get there. It's a process. It's a process theology. The short list of paramitas are these six: generosity, skillful ethical behavior, patience, energy, concentration, and wisdom. And the question I want to pursue with you this morning, afternoon, is how technologies may facilitate our cultivation of these paramitas, and what questions technologically assisted personality perfection raises. Let's start with generosity. There's substantial evidence that basic motivations like selfishness and empathy and the willingness to contribute to collective endeavors have a genetic component. And here I'm indebted actually to Mark's paper, which he'll be delivering Saturday, I believe, actually. He'll about genetic virtue, because Mark has done some good groundwork on this. Even if we don't give credence to the idea of a sociobiological impulse to selfless behavior, which is actually far better for building a case for nepotism and racism than it is for building a case for general universal compassion in any case, there is a basic set of neurological perquisites for the experience or the exercise of compassion and social contractarian thinking. You have to be a certain kind of brain, a certain kind of body, to actually experience and act on the basis of compassion and social contractarian thinking. You need to be aware of your own sufferings, and then you need to be able to imagine that other people suffer the same way that you do, and to put yourself in their shoes so convincingly that you are motivated to give up some of your time and your treasure in order to stop their suffering. Or at least you need to be cognitively complex enough to imagine a social contract with general reciprocity. The more people who act generous like you, the better everything will be. Research shows that everyone's personality, so those are some basic cognitive elements that we need to have in order to be compassionate, but now we can get even more specific. Because research also shows that everyone's personality can be described as a mix of five basic characteristics, all of which are substantially inherited and stable across life. So the basic capacities, we have to be human in order to have those basic capacities, and hopefully there'll be other non-human forms in the future that have them. But then once you're human, you can have them, the knob turned up or down for those capacities. So those capacities are openness to experience, conscientiousness, extroversion, agreeableness, and neuroticism. Again, thanks to Mark for pointing this out to me. One of the five-factor researchers at the University of British Columbia, Carrie Jang, has found that agreeableness or sociability and the associated beliefs and attitudes are especially strongly influenced by genes. People who score high on sociability are more compassionate, trusting, and helpful, while people low in sociability are uncooperative, unsympathetic, and easily irritated. Jang also finds that these personality traits are related to political attitudes. People who inherit high sociability were more, in his research, were more likely to find to favor gender equality and open-door policies for immigrants. So it seems quite likely that within a couple of decades, we will have ways of enhancing our personality, our generosity, our selflessness, our empathy, genetically, pharmaceutically, nanoneurally, and with information technology. We may be able to take a gene tweak to increase our natural ecstasy production. I'm talking about the drug here, not the experience, without the dehydration, and a cognitive tweak to improve our emotional intelligence. We may be able to provide our children and ourselves with electronic superegos, reminding us of our own moral code, pointing out lapses, or even subtly adjusting our motivations and feelings so that we act more selflessly and generously. And I carry around a PDA, by the way, and record my diet in it. And I fully imagine, you know, that requires that you actually be honest about what you're eating. But I fully imagine at some point your PDA will be, you know, interacting with your glasses, and it will automatically measure the weight of the thing that you're putting in your mouth and say, you know, that's really, you know, that's not 2 ounces, that's actually 4 ounces. And now you're over your limit for carbs for the day, so you have to stop eating. It'll nag you, and then you have to turn it off. And okay, so that's the way I imagine this coming out. Which brings us to skillful ethical behavior. This starts with not doing ourselves or other people harm by paying close attention to the effects that we have on the world and controlling our behaviors that cause harm. The five commandments of the Buddhist ethical code are to avoid killing, lying, stealing, sexual misconduct, and intoxicants. The first four because they tend to hurt other people, and the last because it makes it harder to keep yourself from doing things that hurt yourself and other people. So there are two components to ethical, skillful ethical behavior, the attention and the self-control. And both of these, we already have therapies and technologies to help people with. For instance, for people who have a problem paying attention, we have Ritalin and other stimulant medications, and their new designer versions with fewer side effects. The American Pediatric Association thinks that about 5 to 10% of U.S. kids and 3% of adults have ADD severe enough to benefit from stimulants. But I would put that number much higher. It's actually squishy. If you read the President's Commission on Bioethics report, they have a whole chapter about better minds. Is it called Better Minds, that chapter? Anyway, they have a chapter where they talk about stimulants and about how squishy the diagnosis of ADD is. And that's true because it's a continuum. It's a human continuum. And it turns out that people in the lower half of the population can generally benefit from stimulant medication. So that freaks out the bioluddites. And for us, we go, well, yeah, okay, of course. It's a question of the side effects. Are there clinical risks to this? We can safely assume that there will eventually be cognitive enhancers that will safely improve everyone's ability to pay attention to thoughts, speech, and actions to have the Ritalin effect for all people. And most of us would probably trade a little bit of clinical risk for those abilities. And I just point out here parenthetically, in the Zen tradition, it said that the first green tea plants in China grew when the founder of the Zen school, Bodhidharma, tore off his own eyelids and threw them out of his cave in frustration at his sleepiness during meditation. So I think it's safe to say that the Buddhist tradition accepts a little bit of clinical risk for the value of attentiveness. Once you see the potential negative impulse, now we're back to skillful ethical thought. Once you see that negative impulse, do you have the willpower to stop it? Or is your mind constructed in such a way that those impulses just get full force in your behavior and you don't stop it? One example of the modulation of harmful impulses is through testosterone suppression. It turns out that testosterone is one of the worst poisons in the world because it causes us to kill ourselves and kill other people and act in a generally crappy way. And in particular, for people who have a history of sexual violence, it turns out that testosterone suppression, either through castration or through hormone treatments, dramatically reduces repeat offenses in those sex offenders, while significantly enhancing the perp's quality of life. No longer are they plagued by violent or shameful thoughts. It's not only that they're not getting in trouble, they don't have that stuff going on in their head anymore. Parenthetically, castration is also a demonstrated life extender for men. Unfortunately, the Buddhist tradition appears to frown on castration, as eunuchs are barred from ordination. But Jesus appears to be pretty encouraging of it. And here I have to refer back to my notes, because I have the biblical citation. You have to give a talk about religion, you have to have a biblical citation. In Matthew 19, 10 to 12, the disciples ask if it's okay to marry at all because of sex. And Jesus replied, "All men cannot receive this saying, save they to whom it is given. For there are some eunuchs which were so born from their mother's womb, and there are some eunuchs which were made eunuchs of men, and there are eunuchs which have been made themselves for the kingdom of heaven's sake. He that is able to receive it, let him receive this teaching." So perhaps, at least for Christians, chemical testosterone suppression, or perhaps even surgical, will be one of the technological assists for their ethical behavior. I don't think we need to go there, actually. We'll probably have other workarounds for testosterone, and testosterone also has some positive quality of life effects. But at any rate, it suggests the direction. We're already in the situation with testosterone suppression for sexual offenders of trying to modulate people's basic motivational structures. The other half of ethical behavior is to actually do good in the world, for which the bodhisattva cultivates, which is what is referred to as upaya, or skill in the liberation of others. Upaya entails both personal good works as well as civic engagement. One of the ways that the bodhisattva exercises upaya, or skill in liberation, is by building utopian pure lands. And this gives rise to a whole tradition in Buddhism called Pure Land Buddhism. where bodhisattvas have allegedly built these Pure Lands. And the hope is that instead of going to heaven, because if you're trapped in the karmic cycle of birth and rebirth and you never get out and you're not making any progress, but the hope is that if you appeal to these bodhisattvas, instead of being reborn into a heaven where you get trapped for like 10,000 years in a blissed out state and then you just eventually, it comes to an end and you fall back down into the animal states and you keep going through the cycle, if you can be reborn into a Pure Land, you can make some progress. A Pure Land is a place where everything's taken care of for you. Your lunch is made. You just get to sit on your cushion. You get the teachings three times a day. When you turn on the TV, it's not filled with crap. It's filled with uplifting messages. It's like living in, I guess, Palo Alto. So the Pure Land is an understanding of how requires to create a Pure Land, you have to have an understanding of how the natural and social worlds work and a facility in manipulating both. And I think for us, people attempting to improve the world in general is what I'm saying, education and cognitive enhancement will improve both our understanding of the world in general and how we can help people have that kind of growth. I think of sometimes as the Pure Land as kind of an extropian heaven. And that's maybe you can shorthand. Which brings us to patience. Because it certainly takes patience to build that kind of a world. Sometimes I say that my principal spiritual discipline since becoming a parent has been learning to remain patient with my children and dealing with my all too frequent fits of rage. Apparently, the key technology in Scientology is a biofeedback device that measures your galvanic skin response while your, quote, auditor insults and provokes you. When the auditor can no longer get a flutter or a bead of sweat from calling you a short, fat, middle-aged, pseudo-intellectual wanker pretending to lead a non-existent world movement of geeky guys who want to live on the Starship Enterprise with a budget smaller than a candle budget at a local church, then you graduate to the next level of wallet emptying. I think they actually need to try, however, to bring in the auditee's kids and have them pour crap on the floor, refuse to pick it up, and then scream, "I hate you," when you insist. Anyway, I certainly hope that drugs or something will help with patients in the future. Mommy and daddy's little helpers of the past, that is liquor, pot, and tranquilizers, may help with the patients, but have this unfortunate side effect of robbing us of both attentiveness and energy. I stopped smoking pot in college because it robbed me of motivation. Even if the universe is simply a contingent, empty, meaningless void, and there is no point in going to work or school or doing anything at all, the point is to get out there and pretend there is a point. Did I mention Prozac yet? I've never been clinically depressed, but it's all a continuum, like with ADD, and we've all had a taste, I think, of depression. The really interesting thing about clinical depression is that people are less likely to commit suicide when they're in the midst of clinical depression than when they're falling into it. Because when they're in clinical depression, they don't have the energy to kill themselves, right? Energy. The idea of what we could do to increase our energy in life, I think obviously some stimulants might help with that, but I think antidepressants, the whole attack on the idea of antidepressants from the our post-human future guys and the President's Council, it's just mind-boggling to me. Because how could they possibly have confronted people who actually have the experience of depression and not think that one of our principal goals in life would be to eliminate this scourge. Now, not everyone experiences it to the degree where it would need chemical assists, but I think the question, which is raised most eloquently by the hedonistic imperative by David Pierce, is, isn't there some way that we can all jack up our personal positive experiences, jack up our energy in life, not just get rid of the 5% or 10% of the most depressed people in the world, but be as happy and as energetic as the most energetic people in the world and the most happy people in the world? Many modern Buddhists have given some thought to the question of whether Prozac is cheating. After all, if all life is suffering and the acceptance of the ubiquity of suffering is the point, then isn't a happy drug a distraction or an intoxicant? And this point is raised, I think, again, by David Pierce. He got the website for Brave New World, or is it Soma? SomaWorld.org. He has a whole essay, a defense of Soma, the concept of Soma in Brave New World, on his website. But the principal question there is, doesn't having a happy drug lead you not only into a kind of personal stasis, but into some kind of social stasis? The general conclusion, I think, for antidepressants is that that antidepressants do precisely the opposite. They facilitate you having the energy to actually get on with life and practice, and most Buddhists accept this. But they're still problematized by this idea of a happy drug in general. Yes, you should try to be, and I think this is the summary of the debate at this point, you should try to be depressed Buddha when you're depressed, just like you should try to be Buddha being eaten by a shark when you're being eaten by a shark, but that doesn't mean that you shouldn't take the pill or the lifeboat. So you can arrange your life circumstance in order to facilitate your exercise of wisdom. And so I think that's the principal question with happy drugs is, yes, you can obviously use them in an intoxicating way, or you can use them in a way that facilitates you having the energy to actually get on with your life. And we'll have to make that cut ourselves. How about having, beyond having so little energy that all you want to do is sleep, how about getting rid of sleep altogether, as the new wonder drug Provigil or Modafinil promises? 20-hour days of high productivity and lucidity with no side effects, no intoxicating side effects. Perhaps in a century, we'll say that Provigil was cultured from Bodhidharma's eyelids as well. And if we have to sleep, and perchance to dream, then let's strap on a dream machine that helps us dream lucidly, spending that time working on building our virtual personality in preparation for a life lived in parallel immersive virtual reality. Life extension through reclamation of that one-third spent in the little death. Which leaves the somewhat less mundane perfections of concentration and wisdom. Presumably some super Ritalin Provigil nano-neural interface will allow us to concentrate the mind like never before, like we've wired that drunken monkey stung with bees, the mind, with an off switch. Twist that little inner knob and you've laser focused on that candle or that orgasm or that mind-numbing committee meeting for as long as it takes. And so far, so good. But it is one of our most trenchant and turning to wisdom, it is one of our most trenchant and intractable truisms that technology and practical intelligence do not bring wisdom. We are constantly told, in fact, that technology is outpacing our wisdom. And of course, as transhumanists, we don't believe that at all. And what we should turn around and ask the question, is there any way in which technologies may actually facilitate our acquiring of wisdom? The specific term for wisdom in Buddhism is prajna, or prajna. Buddhists have as many words for wisdom as Eskimos have for snow. Prajna in the Buddhist tradition is the synthesis of incisive, discursive intellectual analysis with the mental clarity and fearlessness of spacious mind. These two things come together. So you actually have to have thoughts and a good processing intellectual mind, and then it has to take place in this spacious mental clarity. I think of it like carving an ice sculpture with a buzzsaw in a large, well-lit room. You have lots of room to work, you can see exactly what you're doing, and you have this perfect tool to do it with. One of the consequences of such fearless wisdom turned on one's own mind is the realization that there is no self. I've recently written an essay for Better Humans that argues this point more elaborately, but in short, I think that the combination of life extension technology with nano-neural technology will permit us all to live long enough and to transmigrate our consciousnesses to new platforms and bodies with our slowly accumulating weight of karmic memories and personal baggage, so that we will eventually let go of the neurotic need for personal, isolated continuity in return for a more complex, celebratory, collective continuity, sharing our dreams, our feelings, our thoughts with the rest of networked humanity through some kind of psychic kazaa or public library, pouring our little cup of experience and intelligence into the ocean and giving it a vigorous stir. Maybe what we'll do is taste transcension and then intentionally keep embodiment in order to communicate with the uplifted rabbits and toasters who haven't quite gotten there yet. That is, after all, the mission of the Bodhisattva is to forestall their own transcension into nirvana in order to stay in the world. And the four vows of the Bodhisattva are to enlighten all beings, although they remain numberless, to exhaust all mental purities, although they remain inexhaustible, to master all wisdom, although wisdom is immeasurable, and to attain the way, although it is unattainable. So that commitment to stay here engaged with these compassionate tasks and these personal growth tasks in the world are limitless. And it may be that that's the way that many of us will live our lives, with that kind of taste of letting go, but still remaining in some kind of embodiment. I'm currently working on a book about this question of cyborg Buddhism, and I've been anticipating some of the responses it's likely to receive from Buddhists. Some of that dialogue involves the culling out of the essential humanist and rationalist aspects of Buddhism from the cultural and the superstitious stuff. Just as it doesn't make any difference if you chant in English or Pali or use a cushion or a beanbag, it really shouldn't make any difference if you take Provigil instead of drink green tea. So that's the kind of superficial level. But I will close with one objection that I think is the most cogent, and it goes to the heart of our transhumanist rejection of the myth of authenticity, and also relates to Mark's talk about why God, if there was a God, would have given us the task of self-improvement. In our post-human future, Francis Fukuyama argues that enhancement technologies will rob us of a sense of accomplishment. And it's an idea I've frequently rubbished. I often say, well, then diabetics should feel more virtuous if they control their blood sugar through insulin, right? Which is absurd. But the mountain climber does feel different about getting to the summit if they take a helicopter. And I think there will be an experiential difference between achieving enlightenment as an optional part of an operating system upgrade that you get in a matter of seconds, rather than spending years in community with fellow seekers. And here I'm not just talking about an experience of enlightenment, but if all these technologies that I've referenced here come to pass, it may be that becoming an ethical person, it may be that leading an ethical life will be just simply a matter of switching a button in your head. And if that comes as a matter of a technological upgrade rather than spending life in a community with other people, talking about your life, having struggles, sitting on a cushion, trying to tame the drunken monkey of mind, perhaps the compensation will come from us seeing new horizons of wisdom and insight from those new plateaus, heights that will require some kind of long slog of their own. Or perhaps we'll still choose to participate in spiritual slog and not just take the pill or not just have the upgrade and slog it out like people who like to ride horses even though they have a car. The point, of course, is that it will be voluntary. And for those without the need to slog, generosity, patience, self-control, energy, and I think even wisdom will be easily available. The world will have to be a better place when that's the case. Thank you. Today on Change Surfer Radio, we've been listening to a talk I gave at the University of Toronto on August the 5th, 2004, on Buddhism and Transhumanism, the Technologies of Self-Perfection. The talk was part of a day-long symposium organized by the World Transhumanist Association on religious transhumanism, about which you can find out more at transhumanism.org. You've been listening to Change Surfer Radio. Change Surfer Radio is produced at WHUS Stores at the University of Connecticut. If you want to learn more about democratic transhumanism, or you want to share your thoughts about today's show with me, Dr. J, email me at jhughes, that's J-H-U-G-H-E-S, at changesurfer.com. At the Change Surfer website, you can find past and future shows archived in streaming MP3 thanks to the Infos Radio Project. Also, at www.changesurfer.com are instructions on how to order copies of our shows and myriad relevant links. So educate, agitate, and organize. And I hope to meet you in a sexy, high-tech, and yet radically democratic future.